Hey Jake.
Glad to have you with me today. I just want to tell everyone that you're on a family connection, phone connection from prison. And good morning. How are you doing?
Good morning, Steve. God bless you, sir.
Yeah, thank you. You too as well. So, give me a quick update on your situation, where you're at, what you're doing, and what is happening currently in your case.
Thanks. I'm currently in Brooklyn, MDC. Today is day 748 of my political imprisonment in the United States of America without a trial for standing up and exercising my constitutional right to redress my grievances, to petition my government, and stand firmly and against the stolen election and January 6th of 2021.
Yeah, and when you say you're in Brooklyn, so you're, as most people think, they think that all January 6th defendants are in D.C., but you're not. You're actually in New York right now.
Yeah, I've been moved 12 times in 2 years, in 2 years and almost 3 weeks now. They have subjected me to something the feds do called diesel therapy, which is a form of torture they use on federal inmates to basically keep them shuffled around, moving from jail to jail to keep them unmoored. They can't settle in. They can't get family visitation. They can't get their discovery access, like all of their hard drives and all of the stuff that they should be able to use to review their case and all the evidence against them. And break their willpower, basically, when you just can't get settled in and you're unmoored and just shifting around, it just breaks your will to fight. It has not done that to me by the grace of God. I still have so much fight left in me. If they only knew, it is a form. Sure, and I have been subjected to it by the hands of our own government. It's cruel and unusual punishment. I mean, that is just one of the many forms of cruel and unusual punishment and inhumane conditions I've been having to live under for the last nearly 25 months, including the probably the most severe of which is 19 of those months have been in solitary confinement, 22 or 23 hours a day in a cell.
Wow. Now, why do you think it is that you've been moved around so much? And that also has happened to some of the other defendants. But in the case of, say, for instance, the guys that are in the DC Gulag, most of those maybe had a stop or two before they got there, but they've spent now the last year plus in one location. That's not to diminish the treatment that they've received as well, because it's been pretty tough on them also for similar and other reasons. But why are they in one place for so long and you've been bounced around 12 different times?
Mainly I was there for a year from February to February 21 to 22 with all my brothers. I was one of the first people there. First batches brought in on January 16th. I was arrested and I got there like February 2nd or 3rd or something. And I've been moved around so much just because I'm so outspoken, because I refuse to let the government silence me. I refuse to let this disgusting despotic tyranny and this communist regime that is currently occupying the White House break my conviction and lessen my resolve to continue to speak out against them, against the, I mean, horrendous treatment of political prisoners, against the two-tier justice system that the Biden regime has purposely brought us to Washington, D.C. to have us judged by extremist liberals, not just in the jury pool, but also the federal prosecutors, the judge, and all those who are involved in our detainment have inherent hatred for conservatives, Trump supporters, red-blooded American patriots, because they differ from us so, drastically, ideologically, that they can't possibly have our best interests at heart. These jailers, the DOC, BOP, the Bureau of Prisons and the Department of Corrections and the U.S. Marshals are all complicit as well too in our torture and inhumane and cruel and unusual punishment. I can tell you what, Steve, there's no justice happening in the courtroom. There's no justice happening in the jailhouses. The January 6ers need to be released immediately. We've suffered enough.
Well, you know that I was there for the first Oath Keepers trial for all 9 weeks, every day covering that trial. And when you say there's no justice in a DC courthouse, you're absolutely correct. On that, you and I will agree 100%. But there may be some things around the edges that you and I may not completely agree on. We may not agree on all the details or maybe all the interpretations of specific events that happened on January 6th that got us to where we each are today. But I think that we can ultimately agree on two things. I think from all of the research and background that I've done on your case, that we're both looking for two things primarily. A, we want to know the truth of what happened that day. And B, we want justice. That's it. I mean, at the end of the day, truth and justice is what's going to serve you. It's what's going to serve me. It's going to serve the rest of the J6 defendants. And it's what's going to serve America if we can get those two things. And so reasonable men can differ on the paths that we take to discover that truth. But if that is our goal, then we can all get there. Now, and when I say that, by the way, Jake, I'm not talking about this bullshit of your truth and my truth, you know, that woke nonsense. You know, that's
you're
not
scaring me there, Steve.
Yeah, no, that's not what I'm talking about at all. I'm talking about the truth. And frankly, I don't care. Yeah, frankly, I don't care where that leads. I don't care if the truth of January 6th leads to it being nothing more than just this organically developed protest that turned into a riot that turned really, really bad and people died. I don't care if we discover that it was an inside job that leads to either Trump's desk, Pelosi's desk, or McConnell's death. I don't care. All I want is the truth. And here's why. Because I want the innocent, just as you stated, to be released to their families. And I want the guilty to face fair and humane justice, if in fact that's what they deserve. And to that end, as a result of that, for the last 2 years, I've dedicated almost, you know, entirely the last 2 years to very high level investigative work to discover and find the truth. And that's not based on an agenda or a narrative of either side of the political spectrum. It's what I said before. I want truth, justice, and what we, you know, I'm not trying to be trite here, but what we would have normally said in a more distant past, the American way, truth, justice, and American way. All right. So that said, and I want to get into some specific questions about your case that you may or may not have had to
answer. Let me make a comment on that quick before this next question.
Yeah, man.
I believe. Yeah. Thank you. First of all, thank you for your time for this work, and God bless you for being an actual journalist, Steve. That's rare, few and far between. But I believe that the justice, those that are guilty, that should and needs to be served, we will find comes completely from the other side of the fence that day. All of the Capitol police officers that were complicit in the four murders of unarmed American citizens, the U.S. Congress officials like Nancy Pelosi and people in her camp that were so complicit and helped organize and orchestrate the events of January 6th and create a powder keg up at the Capitol that day. In my most fervent opinion, every single January 6th patriot was there standing up using their rightful God-given ability to stand against tyranny, to peacefully protest. And when we were attacked first, we defended ourselves, the people around the country, and nobody that is a January 6th protester is guilty of anything other than helping maintain the convictions and the resolve, the principles that make America what America is. You know, Thomas Jefferson said, basically, paraphrase, a little resistance to the government every once in a while is good for a nation. And how else would a government know that its citizens still maintain that spirit of resistance? And that's what January 6th was. That's the spirit of resistance. That's the American spirit to defend our Constitution and to say, we are not going for it. We're not going for a stolen election and an installment of a communist puppet leader who's bought and paid for by China, who's a pedophile, who has a horrendous political track record, who's a racist. We're just not going for it. And January 6th was a revoking of the consent of the American people and brave, brave patriots standing unarmed against a tyrannical force, the Capitol Police and all of the Congress people inside that were voting to certify a stolen election. They were not adhering to the will of the American people, and the will of the American people stood up million deep at the Capitol that day to stand strong against that. And so the arrests and the justice in Jan 6ers, not even for the quote unquote violent Jan 6ers such as myself, it is for the Capitol police officers that brutally assaulted and maimed and injured and turned their weapons against their own people that they're sworn an oath to protect. That's my most fervent belief, Steve.
Let's dive in here, and I'll set up this first question with one simple sentence. I was there as well, as you know. I was there January 6th. I was covering the event as a journalist. So I saw a lot. I didn't see everything. I couldn't be on every side of every of the Capitol building. It's a large complex, but I did witness a lot firsthand. And after that event, I did a lot of interviews, press interviews, mainstream media, independent media. And one of the things that I said in almost every one of those early videos, when I was asked what I saw, I said this very simply. I said, I saw a lot of bad people who did some bad things. I saw some good people who did some good things. And I saw also otherwise good people who did some really stupid things that day. Now, you may or may not identify with one of those three visualizations, but which one are you?
I'm a red-blooded American patriot that is pissed off that communists are taking over this country. And I stood up and I did something about it. And I don't characterize myself in any one of those places. I consider myself doing exactly what the founding fathers would have done, Steve. And I don't play the watered down version of January 6th. There was mistakes made that day. No, I think that was well within our rights and our constitutional duty to overthrow the chains of tyranny. That is what our Declaration of Independence not just calls a right, but a duty to throw off the chains of tyranny. And that is exactly what January 6th was. And that's what my documentaries are about. And that's what the truth will reveal. We didn't go there to violently throw off the chains of tyranny. We went there to exercise our First Amendment, which is a peaceful protest, and have our grievance heard, that our consent is being revoked. We are not consenting to certifying the election. A million people are standing outside strong, saying to our elected officials inside the People's House, we do not consent. We are here to protest. And they attacked us on the steps of our own Capitol. And we said, we are not cowards. We are patriots. And we're taking the House. You want to attack us? We're taking it. And that's what we did. So I don't play the watered down version of anything. I'm a real 1776 patriot. And I know a lot of other January Sixers feel the same way.
Right. So let's just briefly kind of sketch out for everybody your course of the day through the Capitol. What time did you act? I don't want to start at the Ellipse or the Washington Monument area. I was there early in the morning as well. I actually arrived at the West Terrace at exactly 1:19 p.m. And I know that because I know it from the metadata on my camera. But when did you arrive at the Capitol, and where at what part of the Capitol did you first show up, and what was the first thing you saw there?
It's good. It's good to be, you know, get the category go down and tell the audience and stuff like that. And so the best way I can tell you guys is to show you my new documentary on j6truth.org, Freedom Isn't Free, January 6th, the first battle of the second American Revolution, kind of details my day out. And you can see me at the Ellipse, and then running down to the Capitol screaming freedom and the American flag, and you know, and just full of energy and full of the American spirit. And so definitely go and check out the resources we have available. My two documentaries on j6truth.org to see what I'm about to tell you the story of, so you guys can get involved. So I went down to the West Terrace side of the Capitol. I arrived there around 2 p.m. after Trump was speaking. And, you know, I immediately saw just a surge of people, you know, towards the Capitol. And you couldn't really see like up too far ahead of you. So I'm just following the crowd. And, you know, people were hearing some flash grenades go off in the distance a little bit, some pepper spray in the air and stuff like that. And I'm like, just curious, what's happening up there? I mean, you know, everyone's still moving forward, and I'm trying to just understand the situation. I get up to the front, I see the scaffolding. A bunch of people are already starting to kind of walk up that scaffolding on the left-hand side of the West Terrace. And so I climb up the scaffolding, and you'll see some iconic imagery on my documentary of me hanging off the scaffolding, making videos from you know, on the side of the scaffolding before the police and the protesters really truly started to mix together on that semicircle that they had on the lower West Terrace, like on the ground level West Terrace.
Right.
I'm recording that whole entire event and how it's starting to boil up and stuff. And so I climb on top of the scaffolding and I'm filming down. The police pull a woman, which I didn't know was a woman at the time, but they pulled a woman over the bike rack, little protective barrier, and they drag their back about 20 yards, and they are beating her Rodney King style, about 8 to 10 officers, kicking and jacking her and beating her with batons on the ground. It was a total curb jam. Mm-hmm. I zoom in, and I'm filming this.
Right.
And I go to the guy to my right, and I say, they're beating the hell out of that poor kid. And you hear this on my video, and
yeah,
he goes, dude, that's a lady.
Right.
Exactly like that. Immediately I go, whoa, this isn't a protest anymore. This is a beatdown. This is a incitement. This is a kettle pot where they are now attacking innocent American protesters unarmed. About 2-3 minutes later, the scuffle really breaks out, and the protesters basically say, stop brutalizing us, stop throwing projectiles, explosive projectiles, lobbing them into the middle of a peaceful, pissed off but peaceful crowd. Stop hitting us from 50, 100, 200 yards away with pepper spray bullets that are whizzing through the air and catching people in the mouth and putting holes in their face. Stop reaching over the barrier and punching people in the face and dragging them over. And so eventually they just said, you know, we have to defend ourselves. And I wasn't part of that first surge. I was up on top of the scaffolding. The protesters broke through the police bike rack in the self-defense move because, you know, there were so many people around. The people in the front lines couldn't really move back, and they're being brutalized. And even the people in the middle of the crowd were getting projectiles lobbed into them and tear gas canisters and stuff. And so after that, about 2:40 p.m., you know, the police fall back into their ranks, and they decide to have Custard's last stand inside the West Terrace, the Upper West Terrace tunnel entrance, where the president comes outside for the inaugural right. speech, usually,
right,
or what used to be a duly elected president instead of some incoherent, senile, incognizant man. But anyway, 2:40 p.m., I enter into the West Terrace tunnel entrance around that time. I'm one of the first people in. I'm there in a journalistic capacity. I'm an influencer. Prior to this, I had 50,000 followers on my Instagram, and I was live streaming and video recording, and I was there peacefully. I was dressed up in business slacks and a dress shirt. And so we get in that tunnel, and some people get through the first two doors, and then the police are there in full riot gear, decked out, weapons drawn. And instead of inviting us into the Capitol, like you see on the east side, which was like butterflies and roses compared to the west side, and fist bumping us and taking selfies with us and, you know, telling us, hey, guys, just don't vandalize anything. They decide this is where we're going to stand, fight, you know, to the death and fight these people. And so we were pleading with them, and the tunnel's packing up rapidly to the point where it's getting very constricted in there. And we're pleading with the Capitol Police Office redcoats, and we're saying, join us. We're here in the name of the Constitution. We're your fellow countrymen. Put down your weapons. Join us. We love you guys. We're not here to hurt you. And, you know, they're just standing there, and they're menacing and intimidating and getting ready for a brawl. And eventually the gets so packed in around like 2:50 that the people who are in the very front are getting pushed up against the riot shields now. And a lot of them are people that do not want to fight whatsoever. They are elderly people. I caught this in a video on my cell phone that's in my discovery that is intricate to my defense in my life. And the protesters are getting pushed up. And there's a couple people in the very front that now have their backs turned to the police, and they're trying to work their way back out of the tunnel. And I'm filming all this, and the police unleash a brutal and inhumane and disgusting and all negative adjectives I can name assault on the nonviolent protesters. And I'm screaming out in the tunnel, they're killing us. The police are killing us. We're being squashed to death. They're attacking us. People have their backs turned. There's this guy with gray hair. I remember it like yesterday, with his back turned to the police, and the police officer is slamming down a metal baton on the top of his head so hard his hat falls off, and he's using a two-handed maneuver like he's chopping firewood on top of this guy. Said that is a deadly blow, that is a murderous blow. And so after that starts transpiring, I put my phone away because it's time to defend these people. I'm a young man, and so I put my phone away, and what transpires for the next 3 hours can only be considered as medieval warfare inside that tunnel, where the police are attacking a crowd that really can't move backwards because there's thousands of people surging into the tunnel, and they have weapons, they have helmets, they have gas masks, they have a shield over their face as well. They have full complete body armor and a riot shield gear. There's no way you can injure these people unless you have a very sharp object or a gun. There's literally no way you can injure them. They are fully decked out with riot shields and with batons, steel batons. And so we are transpiring in hand-to-hand defensive combat for 2 to 3 hours inside that tunnel until the famous situation transpires, the death of Roseanne Boylan, the murder of Roseanne Boylan at 4:20 p.m. approximately. Her and Philip Anderson, a man that I would go on to later save his life by the grace of God alone. And all of this particular event is also caught in the documentary on j6truth.org. So 4:20 p.m., Steve comes around, and, you know, the protesters and the police have been going back and forth inside this tunnel for a while. We're very adamant about getting inside the building. This is our house. We're chanting, America never be a socialist country. Mm-hmm. And the police are very adamant about keeping us out. And a lot of the people that are in the tunnel are kind of just being pushed in and forced, and they can't really leave. So they're going into fight or flight responses and having to defend themselves. So 4:20 p.m. comes around. Philip Anderson and Roseanne enter the tunnel, and the police do a maneuver to expel everybody outside the tunnel, which is kind of like a baton death march. They all heave forward at the same time with a mixture of, copious drenching amounts of tear gas and pepper spray and OC spray, which is a very strong form of pepper spray that can also asphyxiate you. They're dousing the people inside the tunnel while also marching forward and clubbing them and pushing them with the riot shields. And what this creates can not only be described as one of the most horrific scenes I've ever witnessed in my life. And anybody that reviews a Capitol Police body camera footage can see how demonic and how horrendous you would have to be as a person to contribute to this scene. People are falling over themselves and getting stacked 3, 4, 5 bodies deep. The Capitol Police create a sea of legs that are trying to swim away from them. And the people at the very bottom, Roseanne Boylan and Philip Anderson, are being crushed, being trampled, and being asphyxiated by the Capitol Police pepper spray that's just dripping down on them from just unloading whole entire fire extinguishers of this stuff. They have a mini fire extinguisher that they just douse people with. The Capitol Police are hearing the cries and the begs and the moans and the screams of people that are being crushed to death, of the protesters on the outside who are helping people to their feet like me. And you'll see me I'm waving an airplane down, a huge stopping motion, and screaming bloody murder. Stop, you're killing them. There's people down here. And they're relentless. They just keep pummeling people over one and another on top of each other. In their most, the police first job is to protect the sanctity of human life, to protect people. And the cost of human life is the thing that is to be avoided the most, no matter what. Even if it is, for example, if somebody's speeding 100 miles an hour through a residential area, well, they call off the chase. And just like that tunnel, they should have called off the chase. They were derelict in their duty and even complicit in the murder of Roseanne Boylan and completely responsible for it. And so I'm yanking people off Roseanne because I see this limp body that is turning purple and blue and almost an ashen white color too. I yank a few different people off the top of her, and then I get a grip on her. And you see this in my documentary. I'm pulling at her like a pit bull would pull at a dog toy. And I'm yanking and yanking, and I just can't dislodge her. There's too many people on top of her. She's pinched in. And the Capitol Police are dousing me with pepper spray the entire time I'm trying to pull her, and more people are falling on top of her. And it's just a horrific scene of humans trying to escape being brutalized and swimming through each other, literally, and stepping on each other. Oh, God.
I know.
Churns my stomach.
Let me have you hit the pause button right here for just a minute, all right, in the narrative, because I want to go back and I want to address two or three things and get specific perspective on a couple of other things from you. You said that you got to the Capitol the West Terrace at about 2 p.m. All right. I'm sure you're aware that by the time you got there, there had been a battle going on for, at that point, just over an hour. You're aware of that, right? When I turned my camera on at 1:19, I was filming people on both sides of the battle line already receiving first aid. That was at 119.
Oh yeah. Now, oh yeah. They were definitely hitting people with rubber bullets and projectiles and exploding people's faces and hurting them.
Well, let's go back though. All right. Because I want to ask you some very specific things based on what you have said. The first question I have is, do you believe in your heart of hearts and in your understanding of the events and as they transpired that day, that first breach at 12:52 of the outer barricade, you know, the famous scene where Ray Epps is there and they shove you do acknowledge that there was no violence happening from those United States Capitol Police. There was five of them and then about another seven or eight off to the side out of the camera lens range. But there was five officers, including Officer Carolyn Edwards, who was pushed over. She was concussed. She actually passed out and they had to pick her up and carry her back to the Capitol.
The protesters did. The protesters picked her up onto her feet. My friend Ryan Samsel helped that lady up to her feet and then helped save her.
Okay, but are you saying that those protesters had the right to shove those barricades over and enter an area that was clearly marked closed area when those Capitol Police officers were doing no violence whatsoever? They were just standing their post.
Standing your post when you're being a redcoat and subverting the will of the people that is to make sure that our country is not usurped by a communist coup d'etat is what the Nazis did. And we can tell them, hey, please move out of the way. This is our country. That is our house. And we're trying to go inside to have our voices heard directly.
That's what I'm trying to understand.
That is our right. eternal right.
And well, I'm trying
the police to, officers I, acted as redcoats right. that
wait,
day.
Wait. I'm trying to get your perspective on this. All right. And that's why I want to know, not from an overall perspective. I want to know why you.
Yes,
thought,
move out of the way. We're coming inside. They okay. did not do.
All right. All right.
Move out of the way. We're coming inside.
That's what I'm asking. Because these are individuals that have, for whatever reason, chosen a career in law enforcement, for whatever reason, have chosen a career to work for the United States Capitol Police. All right.
Their oath is sworn to the Constitution, not to their employers to tell them to stand post. Their sworn oath is to defend this country from any enemy, foreign or domestic. And that is the federal officers.
I understand. I understand that.
And they were breaking their oath.
Well, hold on. That crowd that was at the, and let's just focus on this first barricade for a moment. If you're standing there and your job, yes, you have taken an oath to defend the Constitution, but also
that is their only job.
No, that's not their only job because there are elements of defending the Constitution within that. Within the Constitution itself, we have elected officials, congressmen, senators, a vice president that are inside that building and they're
not doing their job either.
Well, that's another story, which we can get to in a moment if we have time. But my point is that in the execution of their duty to defend the Constitution, they're defending the elements of the Constitution, which are the duly elected representatives from each of our states. And whether you like any individual or all of them or none of them, nevertheless, they are there as a result of constitutionally established processes. And their job, because we know when you are defending the Constitution against all enemies, foreign and domestic, they have no idea who's standing at that line. Now, do you believe, and this is a specific question I'd like to get you to answer, do you believe that all of the individuals that were at that first barricade were Ray Epps and Ryan Samsel, all those guys were, do you believe that it was an element of just a bunch of patriots? Do you think that there were Antifa? Do you think that there were federal plants in that? What do you consider to be the element of that crowd at that first barricade?
Yeah, that's a perfect question. And I really enjoy that question because it boils down to my psychology and understanding of January 6th is different because I don't give credence to the conspiracy theories and I'm not going to give the government the fruits of January 6ers labors to defend this country and blame it on Antifa, blame it on bad actors, blame it on the FBI. I know in my heart of hearts what transpired at the Capitol that day would have happened no matter what, if there was no Antifa and no federal agents in the crowd, or if there were, the spirit of revolution and the spirit of defense of our Constitution was so rife and so pervasive in the crowd and so overwhelming. What happened on January 6th was going to happen no matter what. It was ordained by God. And I think that more particularly the people at that gate right there were being true patriots. And okay. God bless them. I love Ryan Samsel, and all he's right. a hero.
All right. Let's go. And I'm going to say this before I answer or ask the next question, is that you may be right, Jake. You may be absolutely correct that all of those individuals there were patriots, that it was not federal agents.
I think that's
embedded.
The most likely scenario.
Okay.
Right. And that's like that one principle we always talk about. What's the most likely scenario is probably the one that occurred. Right.
And there may have been no trained crowd control provocateurs, crowd manipulating, color revolution type provocateurs in that first breach either. You may be absolutely correct. And this is what I said earlier at the very beginning of this connection that we have today, is that I don't care which way the truth goes. I'm just looking for whatever it is. And I will tell you, I don't have the smoking gun yet. And I'm not as convinced as you are about, because you're pretty convinced. You've got your mind.
I know it
up.
Because I know it. I know I have the spirit of discernment from God. And I know this to be by far what occurred. I've studied the videos and the little time I have had discovery, and other people have had discovery. I really haven't had much discovery myself, but I've seen some of the other Gen 6ers discovery. And what I see is the body language of really pissed off American patriots who are trying to plea with the officers in front of them to join them. They're not here in the name of destruction or the name of anything else but the U.S. Constitution.
All right.
And
let's
liberty.
Go back. Let's go back. Let's go back to my original question relating to the barricade. I have studied that situation and that first initial, what they call a breach of the West Side Barricade at 12:52 p.m. on January 6th. I have looked at it from every camera angle that is available. And what I see with my eye is, I see a group of actual, and by the way, when I say Capitol Police officers, I'm not saying Capitol Police in the broad sense, with like a lot of J6ers inappropriately misidentify DC Metropolitan Police and Capitol Police as the same group of law enforcement agencies, because they're not, and they both actually as units behave.
Hate the Constitution and hate Trump supporters and out-of-towners.
They actually behave very differently. Just as an aside, before I continue on this barricade line of questioning, I actually spent 4.5 hours yesterday with an unnamed, anonymous
redcoat.
U.S. Capitol Police officer who is considering coming out as a whistleblower.
Maybe a former redcoat.
Well, and then on Saturday, I am having a face-to-face meeting with another whistleblowing United States Capitol Police officer. But this is what I'm trying to tell you is that are people inside the government, inside the agencies that we are finally getting to, and that we're getting their stories and we're getting their own problems with what happened that day. I mean, I you may or may not be aware, but 92% of the actual United States Capitol Police gave their leadership a negative vote. It was a no confidence vote directly related to and immediately following, it's like on the 1st of February, January 6th. I believe that the United States Capitol Police were thrown into this battle as much as what I called in my last, my series I'm writing right now about the Capitol Police as sacrificial pawns. But that, I don't want to get into that here on this call, because people can read that. And also the more specific details about your story, they can get from your documentaries, which I'm going to link to wherever this podcast is posted. But I want to go back with the understanding of what I've just explained to you, is that that small handful of Capitol Police officers, they, in their oath to defend the Constitution, arrived on January 6th thinking it was another normal day at the office, that their protectorates that day are the congressmen inside that building, duly elected according to the Constitution. So their job is not necessarily as turncoats or redcoats against the Constitution, but they believe in their heart of hearts that they're actually there to protect those who are the duly elected representatives of the United States. And again, whether you like them or not, whether you think that they're about to do
they the need right to thing use or their own human logic and discernment at sometimes. It's like the same argument that the Nazis who passed out the bars of soap to the Jews that were entering into the train cars or entering into the showers are not guilty because they were told to do a job and that's what their job description
yeah,
was.
But these guys, Jake, these guys' jobs.
They need to understand that what was happening inside that Capitol that day was the insurrection. That was the illegal activity going on. And for them to defend our ability to protest against it and to revoke our consent from it and to stop it was the first line of the tyranny that day. They are the people that were in the way of the American citizens' will being heard. And I truly believe that many Capitol Police officers, the ones that laid down their arms and took fist bumps and selfies and let the guys inside, had that understanding. They had the spirit of discernment to understand between the times and when is the right time to let the people into their own capital to be there to peacefully protest. I mean, you know, we weren't a bunch of vandalizers or bloodthirsty, ravenous people. We were there in the name of the Constitution. And this is the people that make up America and, you know, the true red-blooded Americans. And we have every right and whatever we want. It is outlined in our Constitution and in our, you know, the Second Amendment isn't for deer hunting, brother. It's for corrupt and wicked tyrannical politicians. And, you know, we didn't show up with guns, but the thing is we have the right to. If they decide to sell us down the river to China and to turn this into a communist dictatorship like Joe Biden is steadily and slowly doing and destroy America, we have the right to exercise our Second Amendment. We didn't even take it to that level. We just took it to the right. We're going to protest and we want our voices heard and we want to be inside or right at the doorstep of the Capitol. And they tried putting a barricade up that was hundreds and hundreds of yards away from the Capitol. And you know what? It just wasn't good enough for the protesters. And we said we want to be at the front
again,
door. We want to knock
again,
on Congress's door
and
let them know that we're outside.
I want to get clear.
And they scattered like the corrupt cockroaches that they are.
Jake, you believe.
We turned the light on them.
You believe that the guys who shoved that first barricade over and shoved Officer Carolyn Edwards over were justified in that first initial move. Is that correct?
Our founding fathers would have shot people dead. Just pushing over a barricade was nothing. That's what I truly believe.
All right. I'm allowing you to state what your belief is, but you are saying that you believe that the first blood was in fact drawn by the protesters and not U.S. Capitol Police.
That's not first blood. We were saying we're coming in. It's up to you guys to draw the first blood. We're saying we're coming in. We're not here to violently and anger. And that's what I believe Ray Epps was also saying. And, you know, I know a lot about the Ray Epps story. I love Ryan Samsel. He's a great patriot. He's a brave man for taking action that day. But I believe Ray Epps, his message was, get inside the Capitol, but don't do it violently. And that's what we were trying to do, but they decided to stand and push back. We're coming in. Now it's up to you guys if you want to draw weapons and start to beat and brutalize us, like what happened in the West Terrace tunnel. That, you know, that's up to them and what happened on the West Terrace side. So we didn't technically draw first blood. We're just exacting our constitutional right. And they decided to defend against it and to attack us in our exercising of our constitutional rights and our duty as laid out in the Declaration of Independence to rise up and to overthrow chains of tyranny.
Okay. All right.
It was up to them to make it a violent situation.
We know all of those words exist in both the Constitution
and
the
Declaration
of Independence.
And that's what it looks like to practice them in 2021. What it looks like in practice, Steve. It's not pretty. The American Revolution wasn't pretty. People walking around in the snow, shoeless, and killed redcoats. That's what they did. And that's what our foundation of this country is. And men forgot how to be men. And men forgot what it is to fight evil. And everyone thinks January 6th is some strange and wild situation. This is what happens when you step on the backs of American people. This is what Americans are meant to do. We're meant to rise up. The spirit of revolution is what we are founded upon.
Do you honestly believe, though? I've watched your documentary. I've seen you in several interviews. Obviously, you're not the only person. I've examined the cases of hundreds of J6ers over the last 2 years. But I'm at a place right now, hearing your side of the story and your testimony juxtaposed against one of those actual hard unit United States Capitol police officers who was in the tunnel that day, by the way. He was actually, I almost said something that was going to give him away. I have to be very careful. He was actually also on the front, on the West Side Terrace line. When he reached out to me, because he felt like I was the only fair journalist willing to tell, you know, both sides of the story accurately, that he reached out to me by actually sending me a screenshot from my own published videos of that I had captured of him on the front terrace line, front West Terrace line. I happened to be, Jake, one of those people that was hit by one of those inappropriately and indeed illegally launched flashbang grenades. I actually am one of those people hit by one of those.
I'm so sorry that happened to you, Steve.
What I'm telling you, though, is this, is that I can tell you that individuals on the other side of that police line behaved inappropriately, behaved illegally, behaved immorally. But I can also tell you that there were other individuals behind that police line who were scared to death, because you can imagine this. And I don't know if you read my
mind. Take off your uniform and join the party, baby.
You have no idea. As I said before, when you show up for work that morning and you think it's just another day at the office, and again, let's differentiate between the Capitol Police.
They're lucky
and
we had
the Metro
mercy
Police.
On them, Steve. They're well, lucky we were merciful. And,
hold on.
And we are
hold
the
on.
Character of people we are.
Hold on. Let me
if finish. I was them, I would have taken off my uniform and joined the ranks of my fellow American brothers and sisters.
Let me
And
finish.
The fact that they didn't, they set themselves up as an enemy against us.
Jake, I'm asking you to take a step back just for a second here. Let me finish. When those guys arrived, and let's just be perfectly honest, regardless of what special unit you work for, the United States Capitol Police, you're basically a glorified tour guide your whole entire career, because they rarely have to deal with violence there. They had a little bit of BLM stuff going on in 2020, but nothing like the Metro Police had to deal with in the other parts of the city. So when they showed up for a normal day, and they were not given, the line officers were not giving any intelligence whatsoever. We actually heard testimony in the first Oath Keepers trial from officers who literally told us from the stand under oath that they weren't even in their morning briefing, their orientation at roll call, told that there was anything special happening that day, even though the Capitol Police leadership had actually permitted events. They themselves had signed off on the permits for staging PA systems, protests. Congressmen were going to be speaking on these stages on the Capitol grounds. This was all permit. I've seen the permits, you know, it presented into evidence. And so, even though leadership knew that these events were coming their way, the individual frontline officers were not even briefed and told that they were coming in. One of the officers testified, Ryan Salke, who was defending the east side of the door, and got hit. I can show you the videos. He got the shit kicked out of him by protesters, right? Whoever they were with, Patriots, Antifa, Feds, you be the judge. But he got the shit kicked out of him that day. And he testified that when he showed up at work that morning, the only thing he knew is that there was something happening at the White House. That was the extent of their briefing. That's why I believe that whoever organized what ultimately took place that day set the Capitol Police up as well. Because if you're a frontline officer and your job in your defense of the Constitution, in the defense of against all enemies, foreign and domestic, is to protect those elements.
He is a turncoat and a traitor.
Those
and
are he, all
and
we all
and
elements.
He is.
But
he's
a
lucky
locked,
to have
a locked
his
door.
Life, that the
that's
American people would be so merciful not to show up with guns.
That's
that,
a locked door,
that we
Jake.
That man is a turncoat traitor, and he was wearing the uniform of the enemy of the American people that day.
Is that his job to decide, though? When he's not,
yes, it is. It, of course, the Nazis, the Nuremberg trials made this very clear that the people, even the lowest ranking, just order followers, have a something called a conscience, and your conscience has to speak to you when it's time to join your people. And his conscience obviously was, he was in drone RoboCop mode and battling his own American brothers and sisters who were there in the name of the Constitution, in the name of liberty and freedom.
Jake, Ryan
Salke. He is
Salke.
A turncoat and a traitor. No. Ryan? As every officer who laid their hands against their fellow American citizens are.
Jake, you've already made that point. Listen to me. Ryan Salke showed up at work that morning.
He didn't defend anything.
No, he didn't.
He attacked our Constitution.
No, he didn't. What he did, because he did not, he was not given an order, not given a single order to march anybody.
The order is not going to come from above.
Jake, you got to let
the order is not going to come from above. The order comes from above, way above. It comes from God in your heart.
Jake, we can't have a fair conversation if you don't let me finish my sentences. I let you tell your entire story, all right, without interruption. Now, just let me finish this sentence. Officer Ryan Salke did not show up at work that morning with orders to march American citizens into the gas or the gas showers or into the ovens. He didn't show up that. He had a job, which was to defend the duly elected, I mean, again, constitutionally elected.
I don't care.
But whether you like whether you like them or not.
The second our elected officials turn against the American people and sell us down the river to despotic tyranny in the form of a radical government that is democratic and socialist, they are not duly elected anymore. They are target practice. That is what our Second Amendment is set up for. That we, just because these people are duly elected, okay, so a duly elected tyrant is still a tyrant, Steve. And these people are so lucky that the American people are so merciful and so peaceful and so watered down and so non-revolutionary that we didn't show up with weapons at the Capitol. And we showed up peacefully to protest and they beat us down and murdered us. We showed up to have our will heard peacefully. But that's not how this country was formed. Any tyrant, I don't care if they're duly elected or they come and usurp power in a military takeover, any tyrant needs to be met with deadly force. That is what our Constitution states. That is what our Declaration of Independence states. And we can't be soft to these people. We show weakness for a second, and they were going to continue locking us down and taking away every single one of our rights like a frog in boiling water. Every single year, we lose more rights, and we gain nothing from them.
Jake, I'm asking you again, because I just wanted to be on the record for the people that are listening to this podcast. You believe that the people that breached that first barricade and shoved it over, clearly marked that it was a restricted space, and you believe the people that pushed through those east side doors, those doors were not opened by Capitol Police, by the way. Those were pushed open from the inside by protesters. And you believe, and you believe that those who smashed in the windows and that upper west, northwest door, which was the first, it was the first alleged and documented breach point, but I happen to know from my own investigation of interviewing Capitol Police officers that there were people that managed to get inside the building before that.
I believe that they're all heroes.
That's another story.
I believe that they're all heroes, and they were doing their duty, not just their right, their duty to protect this country.
All right. So I've got a follow-up question for you on that. Having busted through those doors, breached those barricades, and entered that Capitol, what do you believe then was the patriotic duty of those protesters at that moment? What do you believe it was their
duty? I mean, what's outlined in our Constitution is definitely a little more extreme than the lengths that I'm willing to go and that I believe that most of the protesters there are willing to go. But I believe if they were in the middle of their hearing, just like at like if you go down to your county or, you know, whatever elected official proceeding and you wanted to protest, you could bang right on the out. You could stand right outside the court doors and have your voices heard. I believe that would be probably the most prudent and the most civilized course of action. Now, to scatter the corrupt politics cockroaches and have them run away to stop the proceeding was also heroic. And that's, you know, because they wouldn't have that proceeding with us standing in the hallway, because I truly believe the American people would remain peaceful and protesting and loud and chanting. And maybe the politicians would get the fear of God in them a little bit. Similar to what happened in West Virginia when they tried passing red flag gun laws, and 2,000-3,000 armed patriots came to the Capitol and protested with their Second Amendment strapped on their back, that the politicians might have heard it and felt it a little more deeply in their hearts and said, wow, there's literally a million people surrounding the Capitol, and they're inside, and they are letting their voices be heard and known that they do not consent to what is about to proceed in here. And whether we're duly elected or we're following quote-unquote official proceedings or not, there is an obvious revoking of the consent of literally a million American people, and representing tens of millions more representatively. We showed up there, and maybe we should recertify this election or send back the vote counts. What do they want? These people elected us, and their will obviously is not being heard. And so, you know, the most patriotic thing to do would be, you know, obviously to exercise the full Declaration of Independent Rights and to reconstitute and to reestablish those the people, the representatives, with true patriots who would not even dare to go and to even think that Joe Biden for one possible iota of a second could possibly be the leader of a sovereign, free and a country like the United States of America, that his agenda, that his rhetoric, that everything about him screams dangerous to our liberty, and that even entering into that building that day, into the official proceeding, under the official guise of being a duly elected official, to all of a sudden bring in what is poison to our country would even be one second to be all right. And those people that even had that thought to even do that should be removed from office. And that's very clear. And that's very clearly all right. outlined all right. in our Constitution.
Yeah. Jake, do you think that the congressmen inside their chamber, the senators inside
our
their chamber,
the people's chamber.
That's fine if you want to say that. But are you saying that you believe that the people have the right to at any time, any under any circumstance, to have the right to come in? And
not any time in any circumstance. Dire circumstances where liberty is on the line.
Okay, all right, all right. Of course. But you do understand that in a civilized society, that the other side of the political aisle also believes exactly the same thing when the other people are in control, that they have a right to go in and kick the doors open and disrupt as well. And
their liberty is not on the line. Their fundamental constitutional God-given rights are not on the line. They have political ideology, fervent things that they believe in that have made them extremists. But there's no such thing as being an extremist for liberty. Samuel Adams, Thomas Jefferson, Washington, these people were extremists for liberty. And that's okay to be that.
Jake,
but
I'm going to go back to the question. All right. You went off on a tangent because I said one word. You didn't like it because I said our chamber or their chamber or whatever.
Yeah, it's not their chamber.
Let me finish. It is the people's chamber. We understand that.
Amen.
But under the rules, they have their time where they expect to be able to work securely and safely in doing the job of the people. Now, you may not like the job they were doing that day. A lot of us didn't like the job that they were doing that day. But they came, guys on both sides of the political aisle, all the mix of the entire spectrum of political thought, errant and constitutional that it might be. But the point being is that they were gathered in those two respective chambers, along with staff members, journalists, and security details. They had no idea what was coming down that hallway, Jake. None.
They didn't listen to Joe Biden's campaign. They didn't listen to his tyrannical rhetoric.
No, you're not listening. Don't jump ahead. They didn't know
these people
are
all people with brains.
They didn't know what was coming. They did not know what was coming down that hallway that day, in that moment, regardless of whether you liked, agree with, vehemently disagree with their purpose and what they were certifying that day as it relates to the 2020 election.
I don't just disagree.
The point being, as human beings with fight or flight instincts like anybody else has under any other circumstance, regardless of political ideology, all they knew was, for the first time in their careers in that building, it had been breached with people of unknown origin, unknown intent. And you talk about them scurrying like cockroaches. I mean, these are people running for their lives because they had no idea what was coming. When you're coming down the hallway, they don't know whether those people were coming.
You can be a tyrant sympathizer and you can step into their shoes, but it's their fault that they put themselves in that position by being spineless and not speaking out earlier and protesting with us. They, a true American patriot that day, even if they were in Congress or not, would have been on the outside of the building with the people, because this is the people's house. This is our government. All power is inherent in the people, and governments derive their just power from the consent of the governed. And when we revoke our consent and you try to go and rubber stamp a disgusting tyrant into our White House, you will be met with the force of all American patriots. And so these people, if you want to go and take a mile walk in their shoes, oh, they were so scared and they had to run and this is that. Well, their actions and their decisions led them to that. They purposely and knowingly and willfully, these are some of the most intelligent, so-called intelligent, well-spoken people that we can provide in this country, apparently.
Well, I'll disagree with you on that.
Tell
one.
Me that they didn't know what they were doing was treason. They were committing treason.
And see, they're
certifying a stolen election that would put in a tyrant into our White House. That is treasonous. Now, to certify a stolen, now, for example, let's say Tulsi Gabbard won the election or even stole the election, to certify her as a Democrat into our Congress would not be treasonous because she doesn't have rhetoric and she is not an open threat to our Constitution. But to certify a stolen election to install a communist tyrant into our Oval Office is treason. And those people got expelled from the Capitol by the people who were protecting our Constitution. And it was a glorious day. American heroes. God bless every single Jan 6 patriot. I do have to go see. We can pick this up at another time. And, you know, continue the story of what happened with the death of Roseanne Boyle. We could do a part two to this if you'd like. And I really appreciate your earnest and your strong line of questioning. And God bless you for your reporting, my friend.
All right. You've got to get out of here. So thank you, Jake. And I will. We will definitely pick it up again. Thank you much.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Uh-huh.
All right, Jake, how are you doing this morning?
Doing very good. God bless you, sir.
Yeah, so it's Thursday, the 16th of February, and I don't know that anything much has changed for you, but can you give me just a quick update since the last time we spoke a couple of weeks ago on your current, situation, especially legally?
Basically, the legal situation is dire for me and for many Jan 6ers. We're all, unfortunately, having to prepare our legal cases for appeals. I mean, even before we go to trial, we know that the D.C. jury pool is so biased. The judges and the prosecutors will not accept any change of venue motions. They are continuing to allow unfair jury trials go down in DC one after another after another. And so, you know, a lot of legal teams have shifted their focus from preparing a strong jury defense to basically scrambling to create a strong case for appeal right off the rip as soon as you know, day one after going into a slaughterhouse, literally it's like being led to a slaughterhouse to go to court in D.C. as a conservative. It doesn't matter what your allegations are against you. You are a political opponent and there is no possible way to get a fair and unbiased jury trial of your peers in Washington, D.C. if you are a conservative.
I heard somebody recently coin this phrase. They said innocent until proven conservative.
Yeah, it's really unfortunate. So, you know, I've had to make some drastic changes to my legal strategy. You know, we've been relying heavy on a change of venue motion and we're still going to be filing one, but we're just looking around the ecosystem that, you know, this is a very unique ecosystem legally because you have literally every single federal judge is involved. You have, you know, a plethora of different cases and you're able to kind of see, I mean, unless something drastic happens, like what happened already in my case, I'm one of only three Jan 6ers to have my 1512 charge dropped. My judge, Carl Nichols, is a Trump appointee, and he's got
at least some type of legal mind on his shoulders. And he wrote a brilliant opinion from the bench about dropping my 1512 charge, just because the actual statute itself just has no standing. It's talking, it's written for a financial crime, and basically it has to do with destroying documents. And so he dismantled that. And that is the reason, one of the reasons why my case is being elongated out so much, is because they're waiting to see if the appeal court overturns it or not. His decision to go, and then we're going to kick it up to Supreme Court. Either way, I believe that my case is going to be one of three January 6th cases that ends up in the Supreme Court. And, you know, God forbid, that process takes a while, Steve, and they could continue to push out my trial until that one charge is properly adjudicated. I could be sitting pre-trial for years.
Explain, before we really dive into a continuance of our last discussion, what that particular statute is and why it was applied to you, and then why the judge kicked it out.
So it's a 1512 charge. It's obstruction of Congress. It's a political blanket charge that they've charged hundreds of January 6th defendants with, even people that just strolled into the Capitol and strolled out. It's a felony that carries a maximum 20 years in prison. And the reason why that they've gone so hard against it is because they're basically pressuring people it's not insidious because it's so blatant, but it's so vicious because they charge, you know, your everyday American with this 20-year maximum felony. And, you know, they loom this massive trial over their heads, and with all these severe penalties and prison sentences if they lose trial. And they basically back them down into a corner and make them take a plea deal with this charge of pleading guilty to a felony, you know, but for a smaller amount of time, 6 months in prison, you know, 8 months in prison or something like that. You know, this is a common theme that we see from the DOJ right now, how corrupt and how unfair they are, that they are overcharging literally hundreds of January 6th defendants with this charge, and in a attempt to just basically get them to crumble and take a plea deal so that they can have a notch on their belt saying, oh, look, we got another one, an obstruction of Congress, you know, major felony charges. Well, people are bowing out and taking this charge because they're, you know, the maximum they can get is 20 years in prison. So when you offer them 6 months or type of probation or something, they're going to bow out most of the time and take it. And so this overcharging is egregious and it's disgusting. And I've seen it ruin and destroy literally hundreds of lives of peaceful, God-honoring, red-blooded American patriots who just came to the Capitol to voice their opinion that day and didn't get caught up in any kind of self-defense scurry like myself, or any extenuating circumstances. And now they're facing, you know, 6 months to a year in prison just off a plea deal, just to get themselves out of this heinous situation the government crafted around them.
It's not a process or a modus operandi that's exclusive to the feds, because state courts do this as well. They specifically and deliberately overcharge for the same reasons you've described right here, to scare people into taking those plea deals. I think it's more egregious at the federal level. For one thing, they have so much more power. They have so much more unlimited funding in their prosecution efforts. But they do that for the reasons you explained. And there are many, many legal scholars and many attorneys that I've spoken to who believe that this entire concept of plea deals needs to be eradicated, that the courts need to be holding people responsible, or at least charging them for what they believe the actual crime is, and then giving them the opportunity to face a quote unquote a genuine jury of their peers, rather than always going for these plea deals. But the federal government does this as a matter of course. I think, Jake, I may be wrong on this, but the last figure I heard, it was something like 97% of all cases brought before the federal courts are pled out, because they do that on purpose. They so egregiously overcharge, frightening the defendants, their families into taking these deals. And that is, I always jokingly say, although it's no joke at all, I jokingly say it's because these federal workers, these government employees, they don't want to work anyway. So it's a lot easier for them to get a plea deal than have to prepare for a trial, an elongated trial.
Well,
you know, and that's one of the things we also see with the court appointed attorneys, CJAs and the public defenders, is that, you know, after the courtroom, you know, after the Jan Sixer comes to the courtroom, they're going to TGI Fridays or the Capitol Grill or whatever with the prosecutor. And they're saying, you know, how do we get this one done and over with before we go to trial, man? This, you know, let's just I'm going to offer him 3 to 4 years and you back him up and just back him into a corner. You know, and that's part of the reason a lot of the stuff I've been up to as well with my J6 legal fund, which funds, you know, good fighting attorneys for all the Jan Sixers to go to trial from J6Legal.org, is because you can't trust these government appointed attorneys. They're working for the government and they just want to get cases done. Boom, 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 boom. It's like a water mill for them. Just keep it churning. And they're not really ready to stand and make any kind of principled constitutional fight, you know, dog eat dog. They're just looking to bow out and tell their clients, yep, you're guilty, take a plea deal, or you're going to go to jail for a long time. I've heard it time and time again. My Jan 6 brothers say, the court-appointed attorney says, I'm going to be doing like 10 years if I go to trial, man. I should just take this 4-year plea deal. It's disgusting.
Yeah. Well, I want to go back into some of the things that we talked about a couple of weeks ago. And I have taken a little bit of time, haven't listened to the entire recording that we made. I think it was about an hour and a half long, but I did skip through it just to remind myself of some of the ground that we covered. And I want to set this first question up for you by telling you a story. At 1:30 last night, I received an email from somebody who sent me a link to a Federalist article. And it was regarding this individual. I'm sure you've heard about him, this Catholic guy up in Pennsylvania who was protesting at an abortion clinic. And then he was arrested on this FACE charge, basically interfering with access, egress to one of these clinics, when in fact he wasn't. And that is irrefutable. He was charged. His case was dismissed. But now we are looking at a brand new revelation in this, in that how weaponized the Department of Justice itself was in this case, because this guy, he was swatted. It was something between 15 and 20 different police vehicles that showed up at his house. And then, of course, the long rifles and all the things that terrorizing his family, 7 children, all of that for an unnecessary arrest, because we now know that offers were made by his attorney to come in and face his charges voluntarily, peacefully. He sent to the assistant U.S. attorney out of Philadelphia. Her name is Anita Eve. And despite the fact that through his attorney, that arrangements were offered and made for him to come in peacefully and voluntarily to be processed and begin that thing, they still instead opted to SWAT him with an overwhelming and unnecessary force. But here's the punchline to that deal. The reason why my friend sent me this link at 1:30 in the morning last night was because it's the same exact assistant U.S. attorney, Anita Eve, who is handling my January 6th case. As you know, I've not been charged. I've not been arrested, but I was threatened with prosecution. This is about 14 months ago. I went through my FBI interview. I was told that I would be voluntarily processed should the government decide to go ahead with charges. It took them about a month before my attorney received the same email from Assistant U.S. Attorney Anita Eve saying that your client will be charged within the week. Then there was some back and forth between my attorney and her, and then we haven't heard from them again in 14 months. Now, obviously, I'm very thankful for that, but this was a situation very similar, completely different case, and very similar in that there was a voluntary, peaceful, above board negotiation between the defendant's attorney and this particular AUSA, and yet she initiated this SWAT action against this particular individual. And so, you know, obviously I wake up this morning at 6 o'clock in the morning, looking out my window again, wondering, okay, is today the day? So I say that as a setup to ask you this first question. You were very clear in your first interview with me and also in many other podcasts that I've heard you on, that you believe that January 6th was the essentially the opening shot or the first round or the first battle of the second American Revolution. And when you see action,
amen.
When you see actions like this particular Department of Justice attack against an individual who has been exonerated, he did nothing wrong, and yet they took that kind of overwhelming force against him. And of course, we've seen and heard in so many January 6th cases where even misdemeanor charged defendants were swatted. And we now we have seen FBI whistleblowers coming out that have denied and have refused orders to go out and SWAT these individuals with misdemeanor charges.
God FBI, bless those true patriots.
Yeah, who are being pulled off of human trafficking and child trafficking cases to do that. I think we're up to about 31 of these FBI whistleblowers now that are refusing these orders. And so even though you yourself identify January 6th as the first round of the second American Revolution, and we certainly have evidence of a weaponized federal government against law-abiding citizens already. My biggest problem, Jake, is that I did not see that event as necessary to that opening round. I know you do because of what was going on inside of the Capitol building in the certification of what many people believed to be a stolen election. I actually did not believe that it was a stolen election until 22 months later. Now, this is not because I didn't see the evidence. It's not because I can't do the math. It's not because I was not aware of the anomalies that were taking place in multiple states and jurisdictions, but it was something that I saw as needed to play out through the courts, needed to play out in the electorate, needed to play out in our voting system and see if we could get there first. And this was only, you know, this event that happened on January 6th was only 2 months after that controversial election. I didn't see that as giving it time for our constitutional processes to play out yet. So when I say that I didn't see that event in the same manner that you see it in, I did see 99.98% of those hundreds of thousands of people that were there to make their voices heard, to bring that grievance to the Capitol itself, but 99.98% of them were not prepared, ready, or willing to throw themselves into battle yet, but you were. What makes you different, or what makes you believe and feel that you were justified in so doing?
There's a lot to unpack there. First, I want to say, never talk to the Fed. They're not your friend. They're not on your team. They're not on your side. They're committing psychological warfare against you by bringing you in, talking to you, sitting you down, telling you they're going to charge you a week later, and now they've got you living in fear. That's abhorrent to me. Never talk to the Feds. They are not your friend. They're not on your side, first of all. So watch out with these FBI interviews. Don't go to another one.
My attorney was not happy for me to be there as well, but you also have to understand that I'm a journalist. And as I told my attorney, I'm going to ask them as many questions as they asked me. And in fact, when we sat down at the table with the two special agents, that was my opening line to them. I said, I am here voluntarily. I said, I have nothing to hide. I said, obviously, because I've been publishing my stories, my videos about January 6th, I haven't hidden anything, haven't deleted anything. You know everything about me. They had two gigantic files, both of those agents, in front of them of all the works that I've written about this event. And then in addition to that, I said those words to them. I said, and this is exactly what I said, Jake. I said, even though I have been advised by my own attorney, I looked over at him, he was sitting to my left, against being here today, I said, I am here to ask you as many questions as you want to ask me. So let's rock. But that's my, you know, journalistic instinct. That's why I violated that core principle that you enunciated.
I understand. I'm different. I talked my FBI agents when they first arrested me into submission. They didn't even bring me to questioning room. I just called them a bunch of redcoat tyrants and oath breakers for about an hour in the back of the SUV and told them they're a disgrace to the founding fathers and to the next generation.
And by the time they brought me to the processing center, they didn't want to ever talk or hear from me again. I'm pretty sure they knew my political stances. So they never brought me in for questioning. I just badgered them and berated them as they deserve to be, because they're complicit. They're a cog in the wheel of tyranny. They're the Nazis that are handing out the bars of soap to the Jewish people as they're going into the showers. They may not be the one calling the shots, but they're also, complacent in this whole entire thing and complicit as well, too. So back to the really good question that you just told me. Why was I ready to go to rock and roll when the time was there? I don't know. I have to attribute it to the spirit of God that was on the crowd. You know, we were there peacefully. I had no intentions, but there's this one point I was videotaping. I think we talked about it the last time we did the interview, mm-hmm. that I was videotaping on top of the scaffolding when that first semicircle of the police line was being broken, and the protesters were being dragged up over the bike racks. And there was this one woman that got dragged all the way back, like 20 yards behind the police line. And about 8 cops were on top of her, Rodney King style, beating her, kicks, punches, baton blows. And, you know, I realized that people are going to die. And I thought it was a young man. And the guy next to me said, "Dude, that's a lady." Right. And my blood went cold then. And I said, "This is no longer a protest. This is a battle. And my people need me. There's a battle going on American soil for our people's house. And the lines are pretty distinctly drawn. It's the politicians versus the people. And then the long arm of their regime, Nancy Pelosi's stormtroopers, were the Capitol Police that day. There were plenty of Capitol Police that have been fired and reprimanded because they refused to take up arms against the American people. But when I saw these armor clad, heavily armed police officers or oath breakers or redcoats, as I call them, take up arms against the American people, my instincts kicked in. I knew that this, it was time to defend my homeland, my fellow countrymen, and not turn around and cower. And why that makes me different, I don't know. There's I saw tens of thousands of people doing it. I was watching Discovery a while ago when I had like just a gigabyte, like maybe 5 videos out of 50,000 they offered me to watch. And I'll never forget. And I was obviously there, but even the women on the loudspeakers and the fellow people in the crowds, everyone was exhorting and encouraging one another, like, "We need to get fresh troops up to the front, and, you know, bring water bottles up. There's patriots who need to wash out their eyes, and we need shields, and get, you know, this is our house, and whose house, our house," and the chants mm-hmm. that we were chanting and stuff. We were a unified, I mean, those who were ready to rock and roll were a unified patriot force for good, for liberty, for our constitutional rights, for our posterity, maintaining the same liberties that our founding fathers and our war heroes in many wars since have bled and died for. And I feel like it was a spirit. It was a spirit that was upon us, a spirit of liberty, and the spirit of God was upon us.
Let me inject this into that, though, because one thing we don't have to do is, because we already have that recorded, is get into the exact details of what, for lack of a better way of putting it, tripped your trigger that day. But the key thing that you said just a moment ago is that we were ready for this. I would say, and I would argue that
instinctually ready.
Well, instinctually possibly, but you weren't ready in terms of a militarized force.
Oh,
because.
But we didn't need to be. That was part of the gloriousness of January 6th. Well, is that we took the Capitol without a single weapon. And that was.
No, but you did. No, you
made
didn't.
It extremely historic.
But see, that's the thing. Nobody took the Capitol. I said in my very first interview, and it was that afternoon, it was about 3:30 that day, after I saw Ashley Babbitt's dead body, she was already gone, being extracted from the south entrance of the Capitol building. And when I walked back around the front, I encountered a news crew from WUSA, the CBS affiliate there in Washington, Channel 9. And as I was walking by them, they were just on their phone and being radioed from their studio, wherever that is in the city, that there had been shots fired, that somebody had been hit, possibly mortally wounded. They had no information whatsoever. And so I'm hearing them discuss this as I pass right by them. I just instinct, again, my instinct was, as, again, as a journalist, I stopped, spoke to these other journalists, and I said to them, I said, yeah, as a matter of fact, somebody has been shot. It's a female. I've got video. And they went, what? Can we see it? So I actually showed them my video. And can we use that? Can we use that? I had no intentions of trying to monetize a death or what I had just seen. And so I said, sure. So I uploaded the video to them, and then they put the cameras on me. They interviewed me for about 15 minutes. And the one thing that I said in that interview, and they asked me what my, you know, my overall impressions of what was going on that day were. Now, this was still, you know, halfway through the day, only about 3:30. I had no idea that because I was on the east side of the building at this time. I had no idea now that the west tunnel battle was now fully engaged. And I said that I supported the spirit, just like you did. I supported the spirit of what was going on that day. And I said, and I'd looked over, and they had the dome of the Capitol framing up the shot over my shoulder. And I pointed over my shoulder towards the Capitol dome. And I said, there's a darkness underneath that dome right now. And these people here recognize that darkness, and that's why they're here. I said, and you better believe me when I tell you that if they come back the next time, they're going to come back armed, and nobody is going to get that capital back if that happened. Because if 500,000, 600,000, however many you believe were there that day, showed up prepared for that battle, then you're right. They would have been able to take that capital with bear spray, flagpoles, baseball bat, and a few other blunt force objects. That crowd was no match for what could have been used against them that day. I think, because again, as you know, I've been interviewing Capitol Police whistleblowers. I've developed several myself. I have more that are coming out to me. And one of the things that I was very curious about was their use of force training and their use of force orders, obviously, because again, I was there and I saw what happened with my own eyes. But I also was very curious about what didn't happen that day, which was why they were not even more aggressive against certain of the people that were throwing themselves into, you know, to battle, especially breaching the interior of the Capitol. And they told me very specifically that their use of force training is that they cannot use anything other than less than lethal munitions and items and weapons on a crowd, unless they themselves view that their life is in danger. That they can't use it for barricade breaches. They can't even use it for door or window breaches. And then also in my discussions, I have interviewed a retired Treasury agent, and he reviewed videos with me that I showed him. And his use of force training, of course, is exactly the opposite of that. It is, had any of those windows, had he been there, he said that first window breach on the northwest side, he said those first two guys would have been dead before they made it through the window had he been standing there. But that was his use of force training. And so these are all the things that I'm putting together as I'm putting this massive puzzle together, trying to find the truth. And one of the things that I know about that day is that there were legally permitted events. There were legally permitted marches scheduled. There were stages set up on the Capitol grounds that day with sound systems, scheduled speakers, VIP. Some people you may like, some people you may not like, including various members of Congress. And of course, none of that ever happened because of what transpired earlier when, as you characterized them, when the Patriots breached that first barricade and then unleashed what was to take place the rest of the day, then those legally organized protests failed to transpire. I think, and this is just me, is that regardless of the justification of the spirit, I also, as I said earlier, it had only been 2 months since this contested election happened, and that it had not been given time to be adjudicated properly through constitutional means, and that it was a premature action by those who decided to take action. Now, I understand you got there later. You weren't there till you didn't arrive to the Capitol about 2 o'clock. Is that correct?
About 2 o'clock. Yeah.
About 2 o'clock. And so you weren't there to see what happened earlier, whatever, but were you familiar or were you aware that there was in fact legally permitted events on the Capitol grounds that day?
I was expecting them to be. So, I mean, when Donald Trump told us that, you know, he'll see us down at the Capitol, I thought he'd probably do another big speech down there. You know, that was like, obviously, you know, what we thought, that there was going to be some events and some speeches and stuff like that. Like I said, the spirit took over and the Patriots do what we did best and we got to work.
Well, I understand that you got to work, but as I said before, as far as whether you were ready to get to work, that's where I differ with those.
Yeah, no, I mean, it was like an instinctual thing, like animals going to high water. I think that, you know, with Joe Biden's rhetoric, the lockdowns that were, you know, imposed upon us by all the blue state governors and blue cities, and Kamala Harris's anti-gun rhetoric, mm-hmm. and just the overall understanding that these people are bought and paid for by communist China, and their authoritarian regime that they have over there, police state, is coming to America. And there was almost an internal frenzy going on in every single protester there that like knew, yeah, we're here in the name of God and peacefully to protest the stolen election. But the consequences to allowing Joe Biden and Kamala Harris to take office are grave, and it's almost a life or death situation for our country. And if we don't do something now, we're going to lose the opportunity. And that started to manifest itself even more. I don't know how far you've dug into my case, Steve, but mm-hmm. one of the prime reasons the United States government is hammering me so hard is because after January 6th, I went home and I formed USAPM, United States Patriot Militia. This is well documented on ProPublica. They published all the screenshots from my Telegram group chat. But I got together within a matter of 10 days, because I got arrested 10 days later, right. hundreds of right. patriots who were willing to do a peaceful, but this time armed march on the Capitol, like similar to what we've seen in West Virginia when they tried to pass the red flag gun laws there and like 2,000-3,000 armed patriots showed up to peacefully protest that egregious overstep of our constitutional rights. And, you know, I wanted to go and to exercise our First Amendment right while also being protected by a Second Amendment so we didn't get brutally murdered and assaulted while we're exercising our redress of grievance right, our right to peacefully assemble. And, you know, even our eternal right, which is to make sure that our government, our country never falls to tyranny, any means necessary. And, you know, that's one of the reasons why I'm a huge enemy to the government, is because I see our Second Amendment as, you know, the right to a militia and the right to defend our country versus tyranny. And they want people to use to see their Second Amendment for, you know, deer hunting. And that's not what it's for. Our founding fathers wrote the Second Amendment into our Constitution and our Declaration of Independence's language about being able to stand up and to throw off the chains of a tyrannical government when the abuses become too systematic are eternal principles to me that mean something. They're not just words on a paper. They're actions you have to put into reality, because if you don't, it's a slippery slope. And all of a sudden you're living with social credit scores and lockdowns like they're living in China. Just like we lived through authoritarian regime. And so it became a reality to me after January 6th, seeing what the government was willing to do, murder people on the steps of our own Capitol. And it said, you know, I said, this is our stand here. This is where America takes a fork in the road. No, it's not going to be overnight, but this is a major fork in the road. Joe Biden and him stealing the election and the Chinese puppet that he is and his purse string pullers represent a massive fork in the road for America. And, you know, we'll be very grateful and we'll be graced by God if we can pull ourselves out of this peacefully.
Let me ask you this, Jake. One of the things that I most agree with you on is particularly regarding the Second Amendment. It is our last line in the sand. It's our last buttress against despotism in this country. In fact, I've often written that it's the last thing on this planet right now, that one small paragraph that is keeping the globalist worldwide authoritarianism from taking over. And it's the American Second Amendment. And I have readers all over the world that agree with me on that. And the
Amen.
The reason that I agree with you in something that you've said is that you went back home and you started forming this movement to later then build that movement. Now, this is something else I've written. It's been a long time ago, but I actually wrote an article some years ago that I believed that, and this was before the Million MAGA March. And there was all these million, you know, there was the Million Man March. I think that was a Louis Farrakhan event. And then there was this Million Other March and this Million This, That, and Other March. And then eventually, you know, we had a Million MAGA March before January 6th. And I've always advocated that the most important march that will ever take place on Washington is the Million Gun March.
Amen.
And that is because, especially after I saw the rally in Richmond, Virginia in January of 2020, before the lockdowns began, and I saw 30,000 people open carrying all manner of weapons, myself included, at the Capitol there in Richmond. And it was not only 100% peaceful, it was beyond peaceful. I mean, it was as they say, an armed society is a polite society. This was the most polite rally you have ever seen in your life. And so I think that that march needs to take place as a demonstration to Washington. So I say all of that to set up my next question for you. Had you not taken the actions that you took that day and you had been able to continue building and working toward that process, don't you think that would have been and had a more favorable outcome for the long term than the battle that you now find yourself in because of your actions that day?
That's a phenomenal question. Truly phenomenal question. There are certain things that men operate on, principles. And if you don't stand for the small principles and you're not willing to get down into the mud and do what's necessary on small principles, then you can't be trusted for the larger things. That's an eternal principle in the word of God as well. Those who cannot be trusted with little will not be given much. And if I didn't do what I did on January 6th, God's plan to align me to be one of the influencers and leaders from even inside this jail cell for 762 days. I've done 200 to 300 interviews. I'm one of the more outspoken, probably the most outspoken voice of January 6th. And I put myself in a position, God has put me in a position more than anything to be able to lead now. And his plan is absolute. It's perfect. It's sovereign. And his timing is also those things. And so that it will happen. I will be released from here. We will organize and continue to protect and preserve our liberties. And so I can't look back and say, oh, well, if I didn't do X, then I wouldn't have done Y, because it was January 6th itself to put it in my heart to start to organize a militia and to start to really actually have a line drawn in the sand where we say, I mean, we had plans to go to the Capitol January 20th. I had about 300-400 people together on the inauguration. And I was calling on other militias all over the country to join me and do a million gun march, peaceful. I even said it in my messages, Martin Luther King style, you know, arms locked, walking down the street, singing We Shall Overcome, you know, not some type of insurrection or armed rebellion, but a show of force of what our God-given rights truly are and what they truly mean. And, you know, that will happen. I know it'll happen one day. It'll probably be the same day that that we're released from here. God willing, the American people get a backbone behind themselves and do something about the political prisoners in this country, more than tweet about it, more than whine and call their corrupt politicians about it. Hit the streets. Exercise your rights. What are you waiting for? What I don't understand what our conservative leaders in the media, you know, our Dan Bongino 1776ers and all these other half-hearted grifters, organize something. Get together with 20, 30 other of your, you know, people that have a major massive voice, millions of followers, and say, hey, on X and X date in 2023. We're getting together and we're going to do a march on the Capitol and exercise our God-given right to bear arms and do it peacefully. And we're going to have our certain list of grievances that would need to be redressed. Why are the political prisoners being tortured for years without trial you know, why are our children learning, sitting in front of drag queen story hours and transgenders that are twerking and gyrating in front of children? I mean, there's a million different reasons, they redresses of grievances, unfortunately, that need to be had. But this apathy, this lack of action is unmanly. It's ungodly, and it is feminine and submissive. And it's one of the reasons why our society is being driven off a cliff into authoritarian despotic tyranny, is because the men are not organized, are not willing, are not inspirited to take action. And that's what separates me from them. I'm in prison because any real patriot right now should be in prison, because we're living in tyranny. And so our founding fathers, you know, said it's like rebellion to tyranny is service to God. And I got a couple letters here. I got one quote I want to read from Thomas Jefferson. I've been subquoting it. It's very important. He says here, "What country before ever existed a century and a half without a rebellion? And what country can preserve its liberties if their rulers are not warned from time to time that their people preserve a spirit of resistance? Let them take arms. The remedy is to set them right as to facts, pardon and pacify them. What signify a few lives lost in a century or two? The tree of liberty must be refreshed from time to time with the blood of patriots and tyrants. It is a natural manure."
Now, Thomas, I agree. Jefferson. Obviously, Thomas Jefferson is my founding father hero. I agree with every word that he wrote right there. And I agree with the text. I agree with the spirit of every word that he wrote. And I'm going to go back and I'm going to read you something as well. Being a big fan of Thomas Jefferson, one of my favorite reads, and it's almost a daily read, is I reference the letters between John Adams and Thomas Jefferson. These were the letters exchanged between the two of them after they had become friends again. and this letter was written from John Adams to Thomas Jefferson in August of 1815. Here's a quote from that. He says, "As to the history of the revolution, my ideas may be peculiar, perhaps singular. What do we mean by the revolution? The war? That was no part of the revolution. It was only an effect and consequence of it. The revolution was in the minds of the people, and this was effected from 1760 to 1775. In the course of 15 years, before a drop of blood was shed at Lexington," John Adams, to Thomas Jefferson.
I love that. God,
yeah, bless. But here, this is why I think that January 6th was not the first round or the first shot in the Second American Revolution. I think it was a setback, is because the Patriots, Americans, the half a million to a million people that were there that day were in fact not ready. It was in their hearts. It was in their minds. It was in their spirit, but they had not, as I said before, in their passion. That was the first in my first interview with WUSA. I said, I believe in and respect and admire the spirit of what's taking place here today, but sticks, bear spray, flagpoles does not a revolution make. And not, you know, against a fully armed law enforcement agency of the Capitol Police, the NPD. There were tactical units all over that building from every three-letter agency. They would have absolutely made mincemeat of that crowd had the crowd gotten even a little bit more aggressive. But the point being is that they were not ready that day. And I think that January 6th ultimately was a failure of the Patriots, because it handed the narrative to Nancy Pelosi and her ilk up on a silver platter. And this is where you and I do disagree. I don't believe that Patriots took the Capitol. They were essentially accidental tourists through the Capitol, but they didn't take it. And that is because we weren't ready yet. And I think that individuals like yourself and others who have that spirit in them that John Adams enunciated there could have organized, could have used that day as an event to let your voices be heard, use that day to then go back home and organize in the manner that you did make an effort to do for the next 10 days and then come back better prepared and stronger and ready to make an ultimate statement, you know, not just an ultimate statement, but to lay it on the line to Congress and to the rest of official Washington and say, you know, we're not going to take it anymore. This is the line in the sand. And what ended up happening because you weren't ready is that if you go today and you show up with less than a million march in your, if it's a Second Amendment march or whatever, they're going to meet you at the bridges and they're going to be ready and they're going to be prepared and you're not getting across from either Maryland or Virginia into the district.
I like it. I would never characterize January 6th as a failure because of this simple reason. You remember the movie 300, Steve?
Sure.
Do you remember the final scene? Leonidas and all his men, they're in that little, like, all their shields are locked together in, like, that semicircle. And Xerxes has them surrounded. Everybody, there's arrows, like, all, you know, in the cliffs and everything.
Mm-hmm.
And Leonidas goes and he takes off his helmet and he pretends to bow to Xerxes, which gives Xerxes the ultimate power trip. And Leonidas uses that for a setup. And he stands up and it's like his shield was heavy, his helmet was stifling, and he needed to throw far. And he heaved that spear 100 yards or whatever. And all it did was take Xerxes' side of his face and rip his cheek.
Mm-hmm.
But it showed that a god can bleed, and a god that can bleed is no god. And the United States government, our federal corporate government, not the government of the people, but the authoritarian regime bled that day, and the world was watching, and the heart of all the Americans around the country are now emboldened. The American patriot that's sitting in their couch, if they think about it, if they know in their spirit, says, we can do this. They did it with flagpoles. We can do this if ever needs to be necessary. If they really start to rain down on us, which they already are. If you look around, do you feel free? It's a question you have to ask yourself. We can do this. A God that bleeds is no God. And January 6th was their bloodletting. We showed the world, the American people, that the spirit of rebellion still exists here, that we have not grown cold, that we still burn hot for liberty in this country. And we are willing to die and do what is necessary to do, even if we were totally unorganized and it was totally a spiritual, instinctual movement that day, it still shows our one world government, Bilderberg groups and trilateral commissions and all of these forces of evil and darkness out there that are trying to stamp out the burning, shining lamp that is American freedom, that they better watch out, because like you said, if we come back and we mean business this time and we are exercising our full God-given rights, that capital will be ours and we'll never let it go. And it's time that we have peaceful protests that are armed in this country and stand up for the things that have already been taken for us, taken from us in mass in this country, and the things that are about to be lost, which will never be returned to us unless we stand up and revoke our consent and draw a line in the sand at some point. And so I don't see January 6th as a failure. I see it as a Boston Tea Party mixed with a Boston Massacre. But it was more than that, because how heavily publicized it was, it showed these corrupt politicians scrambling like cockroaches when you turn on the light. They fled. We held it down. We had it for a couple hours. Yeah, we got kicked out. A bunch of grandmas and an unarmed middle-aged guys were in there taking selfies, and it was beautiful. But at the end of the day, we had the QAnon shaman at the seat of power at the Senate chambers, and you know, God bless America. That's that to me. We didn't. It wasn't some violent overthrow of the government. It was the people sitting in the people's chambers, face painted, you know, dressing up in. You know, with their camping gear on. It was such a signal that if we could do this, and you know, with people that were kind of there just camping out for the weekend, some type of Woodstock of liberty. I kind of called January 6th, I akin it to Woodstock, because it was such a spiritual and peace loving event of a lot of like-minded people. If the Woodstock crowd could do it, then imagine what the real militiamen and former armed service members and Oath Keeper style, ready to rock and roll people can do if you just put your minds to it and come together in unity, if ever needed so to be, what we can do in a flash, in a blink of an eye, to take back this country from the people that would, the tyrants and their handlers that would beset us into a land of despotic tyranny. And so that's what it represents. It's a symbol. And that's why, Steve, I am so important to crush out and to kill and to try to grind down to a plea deal, because I'm a symbol. I'm a symbol of the American patriot in the modern day sense. And so are all my other Gen 6 brothers. And the more of them they can turn into government lapdogs and people crying out, begging for plea deals and looking to sign contracts with the dark forces, the more they can crush the symbol. And the symbol is always, just like Thomas Jefferson wrote, if they can stamp it out in the minds of the American people by taking what are the forefront, what are the leaders of this this movement right now, the Jan Sixers, and take us and turn us into examples of, hey, look, we can turn, you know, 90% of you guys into plea dealers and squealers and people that turn against their fellow co-defendants and stuff like that. Then they can crush out the rebellion that's happening in the minds of men right now. And I refuse, and if you can hear my voice right now, be as the founding fathers were. They didn't sign a plea deal with the British tyrants and the monarchy. They stood and they said, our lives, our sacred honor, right, and our fortune, we sign off together. And they said, once we sign this Declaration of Independence, once we declare that we are separate, holy and consecrated and different than these people, it is not a light undertaking. And so if you can hear my voice, in your mind today. Do that in your mind.
Jake, I hear it. And I personally want to believe that you're correct in everything that you've said. Now, let me ask you a question. Brass tacks. The founding fathers, who did, in fact, pledge ultimately their lives, their fortunes, and their sacred honor, they did not want a war. And they did everything, as Adam said here, for 15 years to prevent even that first drop of blood at Lexington. Do you think that there's a way out of our current situation of turning this country around without a second revolution or a civil war? Or do you think that's inevitable?
Well, the answer to your question, which you have the best questions, God bless you, and I've done hundreds of interviews. The answer to that question, Steve, is the revolution that needs to happen is the revolution of Jesus Christ, where we put God back in the mantle place of our hearts in this country. He is our rock and firm foundation. And the further we drift from our Judeo-Christian principles and the Spirit of God is resting so strongly over this country, the more that we turn our backs to God, the more that it will become necessary to have some type of armed conflict in this country. But if we can turn in sackcloth and ashes and repent from our sins, and Democrat and Republican find a place where we join together in the Spirit and return to our foundation as a godly country, then we will need no such thing. That'll be the day where the lion and the lamb lay down together. But unfortunately, our book, the Lamb's Book of Life, the Word of God tells us that there will be wars, there will be tumults, there will be insurrections, there will be quakings in the diverse places. And what we're seeing is that age of perdition come about, that age of tribulation come about. Yes, would I love to see America return to its prosperity and liberty? Well, am I willing to die for it? 1,000%. And I proved that. I bear the scars and the stripes of liberty on my body. But do I think that that's where we're headed? If we can tell the weather, how are we not able to discern the times that we're in and the age that we're in? And I believe that we're living in that last day and age, and that no matter what happens, we are headed towards that age of tribulation right now. And the only thing is that is going to save our country is a return to God. And even the cries out for civil wars and armed militias and conflicts, we need God, Steve, and God needs us to turn towards him, because even
some of these ideas, these beautiful idealistic ideas of having another 1776 and returning our country to its liberty and restoring the Constitution via a revolution is, I'm never going to stamp it out as being impossible, but I believe with the discernment of the Spirit of God that we are past that age and that we are in the times where it's more likely than not that this country will continue to cascade down. And the only thing that's going to save us is Jesus Christ. Am I willing to stand and fight because it's the right thing to do and it's the righteous thing to do? Of course. But I believe in my heart of hearts and that we're in a time where it's a spiritual warfare that is going to determine how long our country lasts into the future, because we're all these countries are destined to fall to the one world government. Eventually, the king of this world, which is Satan right now, will take his throne through an antichrist beast system, new world order. And it's just a matter of how long that happens. Will there be a few more generations of peace and prosperity and liberty in America from the brave actions of American patriots taken in the next few years? Possibly. And I hope to be one of those people that helps elongate out this process. But I believe in the word of God, and I know it's coming true, and I see it coming to pass.
Let me ask you one last thing, and I'll let you go here, because I know your time is limited. I'm going to address your case in particular. And I think that what you said at the beginning of our phone call today was that you already, unfortunately, have to be preparing for your appeal as opposed to your actual initial trial. Assuming that that takes place in D.C., we already know that that's a fait accompli, what's going to happen there in front of a D.C. jury. And I'm staring at a picture of you right now. I've got it up on my screen. And you have a Capitol Police shield in one hand, in your left hand. You're wearing a gas mask, and you've got a baseball bat in your right hand. It's going to be a rather iconic photo used in your trial, I can imagine, by the prosecution. Did you bring that baseball bat?
Oh, no way. I brought a pair of slacks, some nice leather work, like, the dress boots. They're not work boots. They're work boots for me because that's what I go to work in. And I was in a nice button-down dress shirt.
Okay. And you...
So no way. I didn't bring any of that stuff. All of that stuff was found. If you watch the videos, that baseball bat was the same baseball bat that was used to bust in the window left, perpendicular.
Yeah,
similar, kind of perpendicular to the it was passed around. I don't know who brought that baseball bat, but God bless him.
Was that your gas mask?
Nope, that was found on the ground in the tunnel. Even the prosecutor acknowledged that through the videos from inside the tunnel. I picked up a shield off the ground. I picked up a baseball bat, and I picked up a ride or the gas mask as well too. So I came peacefully, ready to just be another American there. But you know, I used what was provided to me to defend myself and defend my country.
All right, man, I really appreciate the time that you spent with me twice now over the last couple of weeks. And I certainly, as I feel about all the J6 defendants, regardless of where they're coming from and what their mindset was that day. And I initiated this and you kind of rejected me right off the top when I said to you originally, what I have always answered, what I saw that day was, bad people doing bad things, good people that did good things, and then otherwise good people that did some stupid things that day. You rejected that notion. You classified yourself differently, and I think that you've defended that very well over the last 2.5 hours that we've spoken. But I do wish you obviously the best, and I want to see something change. As you know, I'm working with the new committees that are being formed to investigate the weaponization of the Department of Justice and other three-letter agencies against American people. And so I am continuing the process of working this from the inside. In that regard, we are nevertheless still on the same team, whether our actions and our processes are different. So stay in touch. Keep me posted. If there's anything that you need to get out there, drop me a line.
100%. And I want to quick say one last message to the audience. You know, we've talked a lot about action here today. And we need those listeners to take some action for the Jan 6 political prisoners right now and help support people that have given everything to defend this country. And so please go to watch my documentaries that we've mentioned to support the legal fund that we've mentioned here. Just visit my website and you can get plugged into all this. Watch the documentaries, listen to my podcast, everything. It's j6truth.org. go to j6truth.org. Donate, watch the stuff, get spiritually invested in this movement. Pray for us, write us letters. We need the support of the American people now more than ever. Trials are coming up. We have huge, large legal bills. The J6 Legal Fund's helping out dozens of January 6ers with their cases right now. And so just come on, get involved. This is the easiest way to support us. If you think that what we did was right and that the founding fathers would have been Jan 6ers, then, you know, help us out as much as you can with prayers, letter writing, and donations. So go to j6truth.org. And thank you so much, Steve, for your platform and your great reporting and continued fidelity to the Jan 6ers and continued fight on Capitol Hill for us. I appreciate it. And I speak for all the other Jan 6ers when we say we appreciate it from you and from all the other Americans out there that are continuing to fight and support us. God bless everybody.
Thank you, Jake. Take care. Be safe in there. All right. Talk to you soon.
God bless you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.